So.
Yes, they see you. You're making the point perfectly well. It's just go ahead, Andrus.
No. I want you to continue.
Well, okay. I mean, see, this is where I get stuck, right? Because of the compilation of data becomes so overwhelming to me that I continue to return to this idea that this man was somehow involved personally in some of the most astonishing events in human history. And it appears to be on the level of planning, essentially. So, you know, and I mean, I can elaborate on these details. Like, for instance, you said you were trying to wrap your head around my Eyes Wide Shut piece. Well, as William knows, Bill, and we've probably all done this, syncing up different albums with movies or whatnot. I've done a study of the connections between Pink Floyd and Kubrick films, and it's a complicated story, the whole thing. But one of the syncs that appears in this is, and I've talked with you guys about this before, so I'll just kind of lay this out quickly for Andrus, is that when you line up, I believe correctly line up the album Dark Side of the Moon with 2001. Watch you see the letters IBM at the exact moment that the song Money begins, basically. And it's one of only a couple of corporate logos that are seen in the whole film. Howard Johnson is the other one, and that's interesting in and of itself too.
And Benji's cereals, General Mills.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
And the colors blue and all the Mets colors blue and orange.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, beautiful. So what we have is this song Money syncing up the cash register going off at the exact time we see IBM. And of course, IBM originally made cash registers. That's what they started out doing, international business machines, right? So, and then we have the two cash registers in The Shining, which I believe represent the Twin Towers. So let me explain how this works.
Hey, Mark, I don't want to just real quick to interject is IBM also went on, of course, to invent the machines that process the Holocaust victims, right?
Yes, that's an extremely important point. Yeah, I've written about that too. I lost my train of thought there. That's all right. Where was I? Oh yeah. Okay. So
Money.
We have. No, here we go. Money. Exactly. You got it. So the thing with money is this. Yeah, when you line up, when you do the traditional Wizard of Oz, Dark Side of the Moon sync up, the song Money begins exactly when she steps out into Oz for the first time. And it's where you see color images for the first time. It's very closely lined up to that. So what we, and this concept, more than just in pornography, is called a money shot, basically. It's the moment where everybody goes, wow, right? And they go, holy shit, did you see that? So you have this lining up with money in The Wizard of Oz. So we have this concept of a money shot, essentially. Now, something that interests me is that the song Money is in the time signature of 7-4, 7 beats to a bar, a quarter note gets the beat. And in music, this is written like the fraction 7/4, okay? Now, when you have the image of Isis, there are 7 veils of Isis, right? And we always see her seated on a cube. But in early images, it's just a square. There's no perspective. So you have Isis, who represents the number 7, sitting on top of the number 4. And in 2001, what do we have? We have the song Money appearing as they approach the International Space Station, or the ISS, or the ISIS. Okay, so with this concept of the money shot, now, if you take the fraction 7/4, which is the musical time signature of money, if you make that into a decibel, it's 1.75. Well, flight 175 is the flight that hit World Trade Center 2, or World Trade Center 1. It was the second strike, and it's the one that everyone saw, because there was no footage of the first plane hitting the tower. There was just the first footage seen on television, first footage seen anywhere, was just of the burning tower. But the second one, everybody was watching. Everybody was watching a plane fly into that building. It was the money shot, and it's 7 over 4, 1-1-7-5. So I have to take this back. I don't know if you guys have seen the clip from Get Smart. It's an episode of, you guys know the TV show Get Smart, right? From the late 60s?
That clip freaked me out a little bit.
Oh,
That was a tough one.
Yeah, it is a tough one. Like, how do you get over this? Okay, so what you have is, you have a character named F. Lloyd, and he's an architect. F. Lloyd being Floyd, essentially. And you have a project, a construction project called Odyssey, essentially. And all of this appears. So you have Floyd and you have Odyssey. And of course, Haywood Floyd comes from 2001 as well. And there's a scene where where we see him, the elevator opens and he goes onto the International Space Station. He's sitting next to a girl in pink. So what you have is Pink Floyd, right? But anyway, so in this episode of Get Smart, you have Odyssey, you have Floyd, and then you have a plot line about a builder who makes buildings with explosive concrete so that they'll blow up, essentially. So, and all of this in an episode of Get Smart. I'm going to, while someone else is Andrew, talking, I'm going to find. Go ahead, Andrew.
Oh, just to make some connections here. Get Smart was created by Mel Brooks and Buck Henry. People may be aware of Buck Henry from his Saturday Night Live stints, but he was also the writer of The Graduate. And Mel Brooks is obviously, he comes right out of the same neighborhoods and the same generation and the same soup as Kubrick. And he's he's not at all, like, he's in many ways the opposite of Kubrick, but that Get Smart is not just a dumb show.
No, it certainly isn't. And I mean, there's the Jewish connection too between Mel Brooks and Buck Henry and Stanley Kubrick and the whole concept of a Jewish cabal in the history of Hollywood. I mean, it's not even a concept. It's essentially a fact. And that this being tied in to communism, essentially, as well, and the McCarthy hearings and all that stuff. So I think it's quite interesting. But this episode of is so extraordinary. I'm going to stop talking for a while here, let somebody else take over, and I'm going to find a link so you guys can look at it if you want to.
Okay. Where are we then, gentlemen?
Well, there were a few things that I wanted to maybe return to, if real quick, in the notion that Kubrick, in Mark's theory of sort of this floating cabal or this power center that has no center, and that this is sort of addressed in all the themes of Kubrick's work, and this whole idea of A Clockwork Orange and A House of Orange. And I just wanted to add where my mind went on that is Mario Puzo's The Godfather and how it was filmed by Francis Ford Coppola. And the idea of the reoccurring oranges in that film and how it was explained in the director's comments that it was just someone noticed that, oh yeah, that is weird that oranges always precede a murder in the movie Godfather. So they just continued that as sort of an in-joke for Godfather 2. But in connecting it into House of Orange, the mafia is in itself its own sort of floating cabal with definite roots in the European side, moving over to the American side, and then going from the East Coast into the West to Vegas. And I guess I was just, my whole thought process on that was the fact that The Godfather was even released in a mainstream setting kind of was a notice that the thing it was depicting was in a death process. In the sense that you could not make a movie explicitly about a organization like the Mafia without some repercussions. That the fact that The Godfather and The Godfather 2 were mainstream successes was sort of like a public service announcement that the Mafia is damaged and it's dying.
Is that true, Bill, though? Because think about like when that TV show Sopranos came out, I felt like that was the opposite, where Kubrick is portraying the things he hates in a negative light. I felt like The Sopranos was like total glorification of the Mafia.
But they were like middle-class mafiosos. The guy had... If you think of the traditional mafioso in the 40s from The Godfather, and then you look at Tony Soprano in his suburban home in New Jersey having to go see a psychiatrist because he can't handle the guilt. I mean, you talk about a fallen king, man. Like, he's not necessarily the powerful, all-knowing Oz. This is a damaged, fractured, paranoid individual who realizes that the family that he's in charge of is a dysfunctional family, and it in no way represents the family his father ran, and that he doesn't know if it's a failure of himself or a failure of the game that he plays.
It's funny because you just described like the actual great and powerful Oz, who's the little guy, frail guy behind the curtain who's just controlling the city out of fear, you know?
Yeah. I think that, you know, so The Sopranos is the death of the Mafia. That's what that show is about. And I mean, it's not...
And therefore the death of... It's really the death of Catholicism.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Thank you. That's what I was going to say. Totally, that's what I was going to...
They're the fucking arm of the Catholic Church.
Well, I was going to bump that up and say, if you're going to talk about the, you know, genocide of the German genocide or the American genocide, you're just talking about the same thing. So in the 70s, it said in the Wikipedia that the House of Orange was in charge from 1544 to 1962. That's a pretty long run. Right. And so if the Mafia, like the Catholic Church, like, so you're saying the Catholic Church used to be able to screen movies and give their opinion and they would actually make changes. Well, then that argues that the Mafia was able to contact the American government and be able to say, hey, can we change this? Can we change that? That would be a pretty powerful way of maintaining business operations. Maybe in the 70s, The Godfather kind of said, the Mafia is out of the game. You know, if the Mafia had anything to do with the killing of JFK, well, they're out. You know, this is an organization that is sort of been excommunicated. The church has been excommunicated. And there are different entities or different cabals who are now within the upper echelons of what happens in this country. And I think
or same people, different titles.
Yeah, okay, absolutely. So then I would think of, you know, imagine if a movie came out, you know, in 2 years called Mario Puzo's The Illuminati, you know? And you caricaturized what this thing was, and someone will probably make it. But what would that movie entail, and how would it echo what... You know, what this whole Illuminati thing that's ballooned into this cartoonish image of, you know, rappers are hanging with the Illuminati, man. And the Illuminati is choreographing Madonna's Super Bowl show. And, like, it's ripe for the sword to go through the neck of this thing. And I'm wondering how it will be depicted, or if it... Or maybe it doesn't need to be depicted. Maybe it's as simple and as human as The Godfather, you know? And so... Yeah.
I think if Mario Puzo's Illuminati comes out, when you go to the theater, you're going to find out that you're in the movie, essentially. because when you're talking about how things are depicted, I mean, it cannot be...
Actually, I heard that's what that room 237 is that
right.
Actually, that is. I mean, it's a secret, but that's who's behind it, right? I mean, it's clear. It's clearly.
There's something I really want to mention here, tying it back to what Mark was talking about, just really quickly, and I think I've told you guys this before, but I was looking at this book by Norman O. Brown, The Life Against Death, book on psychology, and he points out that long, this guy basically recognized that there was a ratio between the value of gold to silver that endured like this incredible length of time. And people just assumed it was relatively arbitrary, even though it was extremely consistent. And he looked into it and found out that the ratio was derived from the relationship between the sun and the moon. And that is like, so the value of gold and silver had for, you know, a couple thousand years or something been determined by the relationship between their understanding of the sun and the moon. And so when you look at the trade centers and then you look at, you know, the classic tying it to the two pillars, you know, Yaka, whatever it is, Boaz and whatever, that those in masonry are tied to the sun and the moon. And so you're bringing up the money shot. Couldn't be more fitting, considering that money is, I mean, that's gold and silver, right? And so there's kind of an interesting look at that, especially when you bring in Oz and Crowley's Liber Oz and tying that to human rights and what 9/11 has done for our rights.
Of course, those twin pillars being connected to the very symbol we use for money here in America, the twin pillars with the serpent, entwined twin pillars, or whether that be the pillars of Hercules with that sash or ribbon across it.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you consider the, okay, once again, who wrote that chapter on music alchemy in the Sync Book 2?
Ezra. You know? Ezra.
Absolutely genius. But when he points out that the actual, pillars, the staff in music is taken to be Hermes' staff, which has the intertwining serpents. And so if you look at the music as serpents, and then you were mentioning that the song Money was the first song in rock and roll to have that particular count, right? Mark, you were saying, what was, I mean, the eight count, or dun, 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 it has an extra extra part to it, right? What was the thing about
that? That can't be the first time that.
Yeah, it's in a 7/4 time signature. Yeah,
it was the first time in rock and roll that that particular signature had been used.
It's an unusual signature in music. I mean, you could call it rare in the sense that almost all music is based on a 4-beat pattern or a 3-beat pattern. And certainly prior to Tool and other bands like it. The overwhelming majority of pop music is always 4 beats or 3 beats. And this combines the two, making a 4-beat pattern and a 3-beat pattern. So it's doom, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1. And the way that's expressed is as 7/4. And interestingly enough, 7/4 gives you that fraction that represents Isis. And it has to be so. I mean, even the American dollar bill, as has been pointed out, the dollar sign is the word Isis, right?
Well, the dollar sign is also the snake on the staff of Moses in Numbers 21, which is just a classic sync to point out because that has huge implications, to say the least. It's the healing serpent, which is the Messiah. So it's the precursor for the Messiah. It's right, why Jesus is, yeah.
And if you think about, okay, so if it is the Messiah that we're talking about, then we can relate to John Carpenter's They Live. When he puts on the glasses in that movie and he looks at money, it says, "I am your God."
Yeah.
David, how did you say it was 21?
Numbers 21.
Oh, Numbers 21. Okay.
The because, book of Numbers.
Got you. Okay. Because I when you said 21, I'm thinking Tarot, like, you have the world card, which is the woman holding the two staffs, right?
Right.
Picture the 21st card.
Which is Tav. Well, that's 22nd card of the tarot, right? Or well, unless if you're looking at the Fool is zero. And so exactly. The only reason I think that's because there's 22 Hebrew letters with all
of them. No, yeah. Of course it's the 22nd in the sequence, but it is numbered 21 because the Fool is zero. So when you say
totally.
21, you have the woman between the two staves, who's actually holding the two staves.
Right, and she is looking through the lens of a twisted serpent that's in a very particular shape. So this is a whole thing. There's a little image that appears above certain letters throughout the Torah that has kind of baffled people. They know it's musical because the thing was meant to be sung, but they hadn't known what this symbol means, and it's an infinity symbol. It's actually, I think we're talking about it at the end last week, but I had this, like, I'm looking at this text that's emphasizing, well, if you take this symbol, which is called the Zarka, to be a serpent, here's all the implications, and then it's just a slew of shit that goes on because of the specific places in which it occurs. But it is the shape on Marsetero of the Two of Discs, which if you look at the Two of Discs in Crowley's deck, is the change card, right, which pictures a serpent in an infinity symbol with a crown on his head, with the yin and the yang, with the black and the white on both sides. And so it just becomes, it's extremely significant, especially when you look at the universe card in Crowley, where she's looking through the lens of the twisted serpent, the woman who's, you know, peering, she's, you know, who peers amid. Right, she sees to the other side through this serpent, and so that serpent is taken to be the klipot, that is the clothing that gets introduced at the end of at the expulsion of Adam and Eve in Bereshit. And so I don't know. It's just,
and to look
the whole thing.
If you're looking through a serpent, what is a serpent? Is essentially a living intestine, right? That's essentially what its body is. I guess you could say that for any of us, but particularly in a serpent. And I only point that out because Steve Wilner, his podcast Cracks in the Wall, they had discussed the intestines, a sort of play on the idea of the intestines encoding time. This is the passage of time, the intestine. And it's a sort of pun, but it goes deeper than that, and it's actually a very interesting idea. So the serpent, of course, being the concept of time, and even with the Orphic egg, one of these earliest symbols we have of the creation of the world, has the potential of the world in an egg, and it's the serpent coiled around it is the serpent of time. It's time wrapped around the egg, serpent-like, and it then cracks the egg and allows this potential. This is the same thing we might see in, like, you guys ever see Grant Morrison's talk at Disinfo? It's really, really interesting, where he's talking about different sigil magic and contacting alien consciousness. And he says that the aliens told him the whole point of time is, like, we exist outside of time, but the whole point of time is that that's how things grow. Out in a timeless existence, nothing grows. Everything just is. So you have to enter into time in order to grow things. So we just have this, again, this idea of stepping into time, stepping into all this sort of stuff. It's just, you know, we can kind of sort of run with that. But,
well, I did bring it back to the egg and time. I did a little search here because I just couldn't believe that money was the first time that that time signature shows up in popular music. And in fact, it is the verses of All You Need Is Love are in 7/4.
Okay.
And I'm there's always some clever person playing with trying to come up with stuff, but I think that that's an interesting sync in itself, because that was their global transmission.
Yeah, I just had a music teacher in high school that would go off about the innovations of Pink Floyd specifically, and I mean, that was just something that he said way back when. I just kept with me.
You know what I remember?
That it is rare is interesting.
Well, what's really interesting is I look at this list of other songs that are in that time, using that time signature. Peter Gabriel's Salisbury Hill, which is another, you know, there's a full of syncy resonances there. What was the other one that I thought was really interesting?
You know, there's a funny sync. Someone made a mashup, you guys, I'm sure you guys have seen, of What If The Shining Was Made As, like, a Romantic Comedy. Has anyone seen that?
Shining!
Yeah, actually, it's hilarious.
Yeah, and don't they use Salisbury Hill as the music over that?
You're right.
Yeah, that's right. What's that? Totally.
Diary of a Madman by Ozzy Osbourne is in 7/4. Red Hot Chili Peppers, Ethiopia, Blondie's Heart of Glass. Those are all after money. The Bee Gees, Jive Talkin'. XTC's The Man Who Sailed Around His Soul. Paranoid Android and 2 + 2 = 5 by Radiohead. Spirit of the Radio by Rush. And Tom Sawyer. Oh, no. Spirit of the Radio is in 7-4. Tom Sawyer is has a section in 7-8 and the 13-16. Clever cats. And Time by Anthrax. But
Time?
Yeah. So Money and Time.
Money, time, and love, right, too.
Time is money, right? Isn't that what we're always told?
Yeah, it is. And just to, you know, add the pornography element in, if you take All You Need Is Love, if you put in All You Need Is Money, you have the idea of the money shot in terms of pornography, too, as well. And that idea is an important one because it gets into the Gnostic idea of the separation of the two aspects of reality, which I believe is mirrored in the male orgasm, essentially. So what's leaping out of a male ejaculates is the moon, or the image of the moon, essentially. And this is
onto a silver screen.
Exactly, yes, yeah.
I'm curious, have any of you been the show Mad Men?
Absolutely, it's awesome. One of the best.
I've been rewatching it because once you get past the soap opera of it and you can just watch it as the way it tracks history, I think it's amazing. And I think one of the really interesting things about that is that the kid, the sort of creepy neighbor kid that shows up throughout, he is played by the show's creator's son. But when I look at him, he looks so much like pictures of young Kubrick that it's disconcerting.
Yeah.
If you look at pictures of Kubrick as a boy, he looks like he has that puppy face, he has those eyes. And that show is intentionally creating sinks in these amazing ways and doing it inside of the world of the ad universe. I don't know. It's something about, something about this led me to thinking about, well, yeah, cause it's all about the death of kind of the old patriarchal structures and, you know, sort of the death of the simple money shot and the beginning of a kind of complexity that is what we know is, you know, everyday life now.
And according to our timeline, too, it's set at the exact same period of time as the end of the House of Orange, right? In 1962, early 60s, basically. So if you're talking about some kind of major shift happening at that time.
So wait, is that correct? You have the House of Orange ending 1962?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
So, exactly, so the Beatles?
Oh, exactly a precursor to, and of course, JFK is where I was going to go, but you...
Absolutely, and JFK was a Catholic too, the only Catholic president ever. So it all kind of fits in with this constant war of recapitulation and attrition between the Catholics and the Protestants. And I would lump in, and I don't mean lump in a negative sense, but the Jewish tradition is naturally Protestant and extremely anti-Catholic, I would say.
I put in a link to a blog post I wrote about Mad Men, and in that first picture you see probably one of the sleaziest of the ad men. He's the kind of guy who wants to be, what the hell is his name now? Brain fart. The main guy.
He wants to be Don Draper.
He wants to be Don Draper, but
who is Don DeRaper? By the way, he's a double D raper.
Well,
and a Don is a mafia boss.
And that's not his real name. His name is Dick Whitman. He assumes the character of Don Draper. So this little punk thinks that Don Draper is a real guy, but really it's a character. And he can't get that the reason Don Draper's so good is that he's acting. In every facet of his life, he's acting. And so it's an art form. But this guy is a real guy. He can't get that split yet. He doesn't get it. But in that first picture, it says, "If I'm going to die, I want to die in Manhattan."
Who is this actor? Who's the kid?
Pete Camp.
The actor's name is Vincent Kartheiser.
What else is he in?
I can think of he was recently in Out of Time, the Justin Timberlake vehicle. And he was also in a really interesting movie called Another Day in Paradise with James Woods. It's an Abel Ferrara movie, I think.
Okay.
He plays a heroin addict in that film. But I was interested in... What exactly... I'm not a fan of Mad Men. I think I need to watch it now. Why is Don Draper... why is Dick Whitman acting as Don Draper? Can you explain that to me?
Really brief.
Go for it.
Well, just really briefly, he was in Korea and he took the identity of someone who was killed. They were both bombed together, and he survived. The other guy didn't. And he tells everyone that they got them confused, but we see in a flashback that he took the guy's dog tags and put them around himself because he wanted to get out of Korea. And so he came back to America and assumed the identity of this Don Draper, who was kind of a nobody. He wasn't like, it's not like he had took this, the identity of someone who was awesome. He still made this Don Draper into this, the amazing thing that he is in this movie or in the show. But it's more about him wanting to escape the shitty world that he came from, where, you know, what, his dad died when he was 10, and he's the son of a whore who died in childbirth, a teenage prostitute who died in childbirth. So he's maintaining all of these lies, and we meet him, he's Ayn Rand's, he's John Galt to all these people. He looks to the world like he is Ayn Rand's fantasy, and they bring her up several times, name-checking her throughout it. So that's why Dick Whitman Dick Whitman becomes Double D Raper. I've been thinking about that all week because I've been rewatching it. And it's funny, you know, this thing, but it stopped the leak. That was a coincidence that you just showed us. That's actually the episode I just watched before we got on here. So
funny how that works.
I love it. See? No way someone's the puppet master on that. We're just, you know, it's like the way birds flock.
And that's a sales sink.
Yeah.
Dude, I had a sink last night. I watched a movie about Jason Barrera called Ruby Sparks. I don't know if you guys have seen it. But it's the same kid in Little Miss Sunshine who's reading Thus Spake Zarathustra, who goes silent, right? And he basically creates a fictional character and she comes to life. But then right after we watch this, we're watching a show called Bored to Death that stars Alan Green, Jason Schwartzman.
Jason Schwartzman.
And he's written a couple books, small books, and he lives in New York, and it's just following his, although Alan doesn't live in New York anymore, but I equate Alan with Jason Schwartzman. I can't help it. I hope that doesn't offend you.
I've gotten used to it. What is this movie?
But like, watch it. So it's called Ruby Sparks, okay. And it's about Jason Barrera, like I said. But
Jason Schwartzman's also.
But so I have this thing where we go from that to watching the show Bored to Death. And the way that the intro to Bored to Death is, you're going into a book and it breaks apart the words and it does the whole thing. Like, it reminded me completely of the cover of Ruby Sparks. It's like the same thing where he's pulling this girl out of a book and it's the pages. Like, it's completely in sync. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's a weird coincidence, right? And I'm like, I'm watching the show, and me and my girlfriend keep looking at each other because there's all of these references that seem to tie directly into Ruby Sparks, one after the other. And the episode we're watching is called 42 Down. And it's 42 Down because there's a crossword puzzle and Nincompoop comes up. And they're referencing Nincompoop, and it's this guy from Office Space, whatever. Anyways, there's like all these references that we're like looking at each other. And then the fucking girl, Valerie Ferris from Ruby Sparks, Ruby herself, like steps into frame. And then he's like there with her, and she's like a 16-year-old student or whatever. But I've never seen that actress before that I can remember. And we just watched Ruby Sparks, and now she's on this episode that seems to keep referencing Ruby Sparks. Ruby Sparks is a reference to the Wicked Witch touching the slippers and getting spark. It's like obvious. Like throughout the movie, there's these Oz references. The guy's dog is just like Toto, and she's wearing Ruby slippers, and it's this whole thing. And then it says that her favorite, her love interest is John Lennon. And then at the end, he's quoting from Catcher in the Rye. It's just like, and so, you know, you have Mark David Chapman is in real life and is saying that Munchkins told him to kill John Lennon in the psychological report of him. So I was just like, what the fuck, dude? Like, it was just completely loaded. But I don't know. I thought it was worth bringing up here.
I think that's quite interesting in terms of Eyes Wide Shut, what you just said, because for a very, very long time, the paperback edition of Catcher in the Rye was a ruby color, essentially, with gold writing on it. And it was strikingly ruby. I mean, there was nothing, there was no image of any kind on it. And only quite recently, in the last 15 or 20 years, was that changed. And they changed it to a white cover with a rainbow streak across it, essentially. So I'd be interested in John. Yeah,
that is true. I can confirm that
they put a fucking rainbow on the new cover of Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, if you have an up to date cover of if you buy the paperback, oh no, the horse is on the hardcover edition, John. That's the hardcover flyleaf, right? That the image of the carousel at the end of the movie, or at the end of the novel. Is on the hardcover edition, but the paperback edition, the pocketbook edition that was carried by Mark David Chapman, supposedly found in the Son of Sam's house, and also John Hinckley, there's a connection there as well. All of them had supposedly had the red copy, because up until that time, that's the only copy that was available in paperback in the pocketbook edition.
But Mark David Chapman had a bookmark in his that was the only other thing he bought in the 3 days before killing John Lennon with of The Wizard of Oz. And was literally talking to Munchkin the whole 3 days in his head from The Wizard of Oz and identified himself as Dorothy. Like, this all came out, and you can look it up. It's a fucking, the psychology report, like the actual report says this. Like, and so I was just, I'm watching this movie, Ruby Sparks, referencing John Lennon at the beginning, and then here he's citing, in his big speech at the end, Catcher in the Rye. I was just like, what the fuck, dude? That's a lot. But yeah, I like it when the genuine sinks actually show up like to that degree.
Well, and bringing it back to Mad Men, that is the moment. It's like, well, Jack Ruby, the way it's portrayed in Mad Men, is the second plane hitting. No one sees is watching when Kennedy gets shot. They hear about it. And then everyone starts watching. And then everyone sees Ruby Sparks. You know, sees Jack Ruby spark that the mistrust. And that's how it shows up. And like, everyone's watching and being like, holy shit, they just let him get shot. They, you know, in the moment, they watched it the way we watch The Towers. Like, there's something, this isn't right. There's something I'm being shown that isn't right.
It's funny because there's, you know, there's the really famous shot of Ruby shooting Oswald, where it's like he's already got in his gut and Oswald's like screaming. But if you look, there's another photographer took a picture like a few seconds before, like probably like half a second before, and you see Jack Ruby like reaching his arm out, like stepping into this, and the guys who are escorting him are like just totally like, eh, we're not noticing. Like it's this weird, if you're, I don't know, it's like it could be, you know, maybe you think, oh, there's just people shoving microphones in your mouth or, you know, in your face and stuff. But it's like this almost like not paying attention to the degree of ridiculousness. But yeah, like he says, it sparks all this doubt and all this, you know, well, something's fishy here. And I just want to quickly say for, you know, Mark, before with your whole, like, the thing you ran through 7/4 being flight 175 and all that sort of stuff, I just want to say, like, that little spiel that you laid out there was very impressive to me. I don't know if that necessarily means that it's intentional. What I'm saying, though, is that, like, listening to you say that, I just was like, goddamn, that's brilliant. And it's occasionally when someone does something that brilliant, I think to myself, maybe there are people smart enough to think this shit through. But
I agree completely with what you just said. Absolutely, Alan.
Yeah. I got to say something real quick. Jack Ruby is actually named Jacob Leon Rubinstein, which is what my rabbi pointed out to me. It hadn't occurred to me, so he's very Jewish. Changed his name to Jack Ruby. But the fact that you can connect Jacob's ladder to Jack and the Beanstalk is really interesting in that light. And especially because Jacob's vision is what plays during the 237 scene in The Shining, and when Danny visualizes the blood the first time when he's at the mirror, it's playing Jacob's vision. And so you have, obviously, the Shining is dedicated to Joe King. Stephen King's son who died. And then obviously Joseph is the son of Jacob. And so Stephen King gets equated with Jacob from the Bible. And so to have Jacob's vision is really uncanny. But I like that it's Jack Ruby is Jacob Rubinstein. And so you have obviously Oswald and the ruby slippers of Jack Ruby. But I haven't heard anyone connect that Jacob to Jack before, because I mean, Jack is not Jacob. Those are two different names. I mean, Jack and John are the same. It's the surname, but yeah.
Yeah, I like Jacob's ladder. I just want to say, since you brought up Stephen King, what I wanted to say is one of the things from this list that Andras put together that really struck me, because it seemed like a little bit of a you still there?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, I guess did John just cut out? Okay. My Skype just weirded. Sorry. So one of the things that this is almost like to an extent a personal sink. You guys remember, I have it linked up at the top of this post. There was a Mask of God post called Kubrick on Kubrick, and I took the different movie posters, 8 different Kubrick movie posters, and sort of compared them that way, right? And, you know, it was this idea that the Paths of Glory poster and the 2001 Space Odyssey poster, if you do like 50-50 transparency, you get this really interesting overlay. There was things where Clockwork Orange features the top half of a man and his right hand. Barry Lyndon poster features the bottom half of a man and a left hand. If you stack those two movie posters on top of each other, you get a pretty complete person. Then you have Lolita, which shows her face, and her hair for some reason is like completely like washed out of the image, so she's sort of like missing the top of her head. Then right. You have the Full Metal Jacket poster is just a helmet with no head in it. So here you can place that helmet on Lolita's head. And this is just me kind of being playful, right? I don't think there's any intention here.
There's back, something to that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, I don't know. Like, maybe,
well, there's
maybe
definitely Barry, something to it.
Yeah, maybe something with like Barry Lyndon and Clockwork Orange, maybe. I don't know. Who am I to say? So
I didn't think there was as much to it when I thought it was interesting, but there are certain things that came up around specifically the Full Metal Jacket. There was so many pointers to, I thought we were just playing around initially with the Lilith thing, but then there are certain things that just like the wind doesn't blow, it sucks in Vietnam, and how Lilith equated with the wind and this and that. But I mean, Lolita the remake was
the lollipop on the cover
was done by the same guy who did Jacob's Ladder. So the film Jacob's Ladder with Tim Robbins was, you know, the same director as Lolita, the remake of Lolita. And so that becomes interesting in itself. That was pointed out by Jason Barrera. But I was, I don't know, man.
Well, so this is what I find really interesting about the thing Andras put together, is that I'm left with the two posters was The Shining and Doctor Strangelove. And I found two sort of sinks in there. One is that The Shining poster has this giant letter T, and Dr. Strangelove, if you look at the way it's written, where it has the name and then the smaller text running down the middle, it's basically in the shape of a T, right? It makes a T shape.
The Taw of Cross.
Yeah. Now, the other thing, though, that I took this a step further is that The Shining has, which of course is a Stephen King book, has this child who has this weird psychic ability and he's basically able to shine, right? Well, Stephen King also wrote another two books about a child with a very similar power. And this was called The Regulators and Desperation. And they were two different books. Regulators was quote-unquote written by his pseudonym, whatever Stephen King's pseudonym is.
Richard Bachman.
Richard Bachman, thank you, sir. Yeah, so Regulators written by Richard Bachman and Desperation written by Stephen King. And what it does is it takes the same characters with different, you know, same names but in different situations in either book. And at some point, they call between the two books, the psychic kid, who's basically Danny Torrance, calls over to the other book. He has this red phone, and he picks up the red phone, and he's able to call over to the other book. And this is the one sort of thing that connects the two books, that where they're able to have communication between the two, which is just fascinating. Again, if the whole idea is we're connecting two movies, this is something where he actually literally connects the two books with this red phone. So I just sort of playing with this idea, and I say, well, here's The Shining, which has Stephen King with a little psychic kid. Stephen King has also written about a psychic kid and his red phone. And the Dr. Strangelove poster has the red telephone on the cover, and it says it's the Hotline Comedy, right? Well, what of
Batman
course,
has a red phone too, remember?
That is true. But what I think is interesting is what is the number one song when The Shining comes out? It's Call Me by Blondie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like I said, I would say a personal sink for me is like I was just sort of playing with this stuff. And that was like a year ago I did that post and forgot all about it. And then when I saw Call Me with The Shining, I was like, that's too fucking perfect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's the whole concept of telephones in The Shining is almost overweening. For instance, when he's driving up to the Overlook, the road is a phone cable, right? And then when he gets to the hotel, if you look at the pillars in the lobby of the Overlook, at the top of the pillar that's at next to the receptionist desk, you'll see you'll see the word reception, and then at the top of the pillar are these Z patterns. It's like or Z. I don't know if you guys are Canadian. No, none of you are Canadian. So Z's. There's all these Z's up there, and like that's the sound of a phone when you pick it up, right? Zzz, right. The old dial tone on a telephone. And then you have this idea of reception right underneath that. So the concept of radio transmission, telephone transmission, and again, this relates back to the whole Intel stat thing, I think, quite frankly. And this idea of creating a network that totally has the ability to intercept reality at every level, basically. So that's just my thoughts on that. The whole Call Me thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I hate to say it, but Lady Gaga did that song, Telephone, right? And if you watch the... first of all, Gaga got her name from Kiss's song, Radio Gaga, which is all about
Queen.
Metropolis.
Queen, not
Kiss. Oh, Queen, I stand reflected. But the video for Telephone is all genocide. Like, she kills all these people in the diner, and it's supposed to be Kill Bill. So here you have your Bill. You know, and
doesn't she sing the song with Beyonce from Destiny's
yep.
Child, Bills, Bills, Bills?
Right, there you go. Look at that. Boom, boom.
They
boom.
Are all in the Illuminati.
And she's called Queen Bee. So you have this idea of Queen Radio Gaga, then Queen Beyonce, and then what was the movie that came out with the death of with the funeral of the Queen of England?
I don't know. There's a movie I want to see that.
The Iron Lady?
No, that's Margaret Thatcher.
No, one of the things in this. Oh, Fear and Desire. Fear and Desire comes out the same day as the funeral of England's Queen Mary.
Really? Wow, that was one of them?
Yeah.
Holy shit, I didn't catch that. There were so many. Okay, I have to stop and reflect on that. Because that was a thing. So the guy who wrote Lolita, Vladimir or something, what's his name?
Nabokov. Vladimir something.
Okay, so he actually did the Russian translation of Alice in Wonderland. The first time Alice in Wonderland was ever translated into Russian, it was the guy who wrote Lolita. And so I've been obsessing on Alice in Wonderland with the painting of the roses red and how that shows up with American Beauty, the Grateful Dead, obviously, but then the film American Beauty and what's being expressed in terms of the rose repeatedly. And what the meaning is of painting the roses red. And there's a film called The Paperboy that came out where this character Jack is sitting with Alice from Eyes Wide Shut, Nicole Kidman, on a beach. And she goes, "What are you reading?" And he's like, "Lolita." And she like wants him to stop reading it or whatever. It's like, or she, I don't know. It was just this weird scene. And I'm just like, what the fuck, dude? Like Alice telling Jack to not read Lolita. I thought was interesting, especially because the White Rabbit is the Jack of Hearts, and then obviously the Queen is the Queen of Hearts. But yeah, that's really interesting. So Fear and Desire, the same day as the Queen's funeral.
What did they call Princess Diana? Was like the Princess of Hearts or something?
They called her the England's Rose, and it's the most.
But they. Second to get your recorder going, or.
Good to go.
Okay, cool.
Huh, I wonder how much you missed of that. Well,
20 seconds.
Okay. So the Rosicrucian rose was sealed above the tunnel where Princess Di died. And then also a torch with that is like an exact or very close to exact replica of the torch of that ISIS holds in the Statue of Liberty, which was a gift from France. So that's a thing to trip out on. Hecate is the goddess of gateways and the underworld. And so for Princess Di to die in that tunnel is kind of heavy just on that level. But then when you go into the whole Alice in Wonderland thing of Alice, the fear of the Red Queen of Alice taking her place. And then you have, okay, Sync Jack needs to, if you tie in the whole slew of synchronicities with coats of Sync Jack, and then look at the head off the wolf in Pulp Fiction, who's like, you know, okay, we got a body minus a head, and that whole chain, and then you tie in that the Red Queen is always cut everything's off with their heads. But yeah, I need to rewatch Fear and Desire. Is that the military one? Besides Paths of Glory? Is that the
early
one?
It's the military one, yeah.
So okay, I watched half of that recently, and then I didn't have time to watch the rest. I need to relook at it. It's kind of hard to watch because the surviving footage of it is kind of choppy and kind of fuzzy, but that's interesting.
I just found something Googling here, a stamp that was made, Diana Queen of Hearts.
No way. That's fucking crazy. And so she's England's Rose and the Queen of Hearts?
Yeah.
That's too much.
And she was painted red on the sidewalk.
Wow.
That's not exactly up. The sidewalk. This kind of just to kind of break things up here a little bit in regards to Princess Di. Let's presume she is also Isis, right? You mentioned that Hecate is the goddess of gateways.
And you know, well, Diana had a perfume named after her that was Isis perfume.
All right, so check this out. Now, you might consider this a little bit obscure, but it just occurred to me while we were talking about this Queen of Hearts thing. Earlier on, I was talking about how ISIS is the International Space Station, right, ISS, and it's represented by the 7/4 of Isis, who's represented by her 7 veils sitting on top of the square, basically. So that gives you 7/4, the 4 sides of the square. And interestingly enough, when you're looking at a cube, in 3D relief, you can always see only seven corners. All right, you'll see seven corners, the four top ones, and then three of the bottom ones, the three front ones on the bottom. You can never see that all eight at the same time. And that gives you the fraction 7/4, too, because you see 7 points, but it's sitting on top of four, the square at the bottom of the cube. So anyway, there's this joke now that I heard. You know that Mother Teresa died on the same day as Lady Di, right?
No, I didn't know that. That's
now, yes, is that really true?
Yeah, it is true. Yeah, it's true.
That's true.
They died on the same day. And so what you have there is you have the if you're familiar with Gnosticism at all, you have the concept of the elder Sophia and the young Sophia being tied together. There's two aspects of the Sophia. The elder Sophia exists prior to the separation, prior to the fall. And then it's the young Sophia who plunges away into chaos to give birth to the world. Okay, so anyway, so if we have Lady Di as Isis. Now, I heard this joke, and I think this is kind of interesting, because this joke, I heard it within a day or two of Lady Di being killed. So basically, Mother Teresa goes to heaven, and at the pearly gates, St. Peter tells her that she's done an incredible job and that she's going to be honored in heaven. But it'll take her a while to get her halo, essentially. And so she goes into heaven, and she's walking around, and she sees Lady Di, who died on the same day, and Lady Di has a halo. So she asks somebody, I led this extraordinarily long life of service to God, and all she is a good-looking model and a princess. How come she gets a halo right away? And the person says, that's not a halo, it's a steering wheel. Okay, but consider this. Consider that in 2001, the space station is a steering wheel, right? That's what it looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's essentially a steering wheel. And it's also a gateway, because it's the gateway, it's where you make the leap, the transitory passage from travel to make your final leap to the moon. And so we have in there the whole concept of reaching the moon goddess, too, by way of a steering wheel, essentially. So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
I'm sorry, I got to jump in here. I'm sorry to be the sink dick, but Princess Diana died on August 31st, 97, and Mother Teresa died on September 5th, 97. Same week, not same day.
Okay, sorry about that. I heard the joke, so... I assumed that they died on the same day. I didn't actually research it. Thank you for being the sync dick.
We like that on here. This is good, and this is one of the amazing things about having a computer right in front of you. So anyone can't. It's not like the old days with the radio where someone could go on a whole slew of things and never get called on it. We want that. I think it's interesting that "Candle in the Wind" is originally written for Marilyn Monroe. And obviously the association of Mary with the rose as well, is pretty significant here. Rosemary, obviously. So we have the Rosemary's baby. She's, just saying.
Well, check this out, in regards to the Candle in the Wind thing. So that song is written for Marilyn Monroe. And then it's sung again at Lady Di's funeral with the lyrics slightly changed. Well, Diana's name is Diane. Her name is Diana Spencer, right? Well, Marilyn or Wonder Woman, her name is Diana Spence.
Oh, that's so good. I did a blog on that, and I didn't know the Spence part. I was just tripping out on the Diana part in the first place because of Artemis and all the connections there. Okay,
and if you have, so you have Marilyn Monroe, and then you turn that upside down, and you have WW or Wonder Woman.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And so, and also Master Mason, Marilyn Manson, Matthew Modine, who is the Joker, et cetera, et cetera.
And bringing it back to the Red Sox Yankees, Mickey Mantle, who replaced Joe DiMaggio in the center field for the New York Yankees, and he was playing in his ninth game of his career on the day that The Killing was released.
Oh, wow.
And decoding that game, which is something a project I've been working on for my next book, were applying the Kabbalah to baseball, there is some amazing stuff that can be decoded there. And it led me, I'll give you one little sink that came out of it that was amazing. Joe DiMaggio was born 37 years before JFK's funeral. So when JFK was being laid to rest and the nation was mourning, Marilyn Monroe's ex-husband was celebrating his birthday.
Ooh, snap. That's nice. A good one.
Think about that.
And then the end of Full Metal Jacket, Candle in the Wind. The wind doesn't blow, it sucks.
Mm. Right.
Because fire sucks up air, oxygen, in order to expand itself. So it's basically the cleat boat. Sorry.
It doesn't it end with them singing Mickey Mouse or MM like Marilyn Monroe?
Yeah, that's what I'm, that's right, what I'm saying. MICKYMOUSE. Yep. Wow. Fucking hell.
Do you guys realize, in looking some of this stuff up, I realized that Kubrick has died March 7th, which was exactly a week ago. We did a show last week, and we didn't even mention and we didn't mention.
Oh, we got a shit, man.
We're a week late.
Well, it was about a week ago that we were talking and it started this list.
Yeah, that's true.
Happy birthday, Stanley.
Death Day, I think.
Same thing.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't realize. So Candle in the Wind first appeared on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, which is him stepping out of, or he's stepping into Oz. How is it? Walking onto the Yellow Brick Road on the cover, but everything around him is industry. So he's leaving. So it's a reference to the money side of Oz, where it's exchanging paper for gold, or exchanging gold for paper currency with Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And then if you look at on that album, you have Gray Seal, which is, if you listen closely, it obviously says Great Seal. And it says, tell me, Great Seal, how does it feel to be so wise, to see through eyes that only see what's real? And it's like, if the phoenix bird can fly, then so can I. It's all, I read books and draw life from the eye. All my life is drawings from the eye. Like, Great Seal, the fucking eye. Like, I'm just saying, that's kind of interesting. I didn't realize that... Candle in the Wind came off of that. I forgot.
Hey, well, I just realized something. So, Andres, you said that Joe DiMaggio's birthday was the day of JFK's funeral?
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure that I remember one of the things was that it was JFK Jr.'s birthday at JFK's funeral. Like, his son, it was his birthday, and he was at his dad's funeral. So that means DiMaggio... and JFK Jr., we should verify this, but that means they should have the same birthday.
You know it's your birthday!
Looking it up.
It's my birthday too now! Oh, God. Benny and the Jets. New York Jets.
Well, and there's another thing, which is that Joe had a brother, a younger brother, Dom. So you have and they both played center field. One played for the Yanks, one played for the Red Sox. And there's something, I don't know, I just can't help but see the, you know, JFK and RFK mapped out. And Joe is also Joe Kennedy's. Joe is the dad. So there's just like the DiMaggio Kennedy thing is super.
And the Catholic connection is there too, right? Because DiMaggio and his brother would have been Catholic, obviously.
Yeah. I'm looking up these death dates or birthdays.
They're called unbirthdays.
They say it's your unbirthday, Mark. November 25th. Okay. That should have been easy.
And that's your 3 days, too. You're kind of rising from the tomb as well, basically.
Yeah.
So you have a birthday and a death day happening.
Yes. November 25th, 1960. They share a birthday. JFK Jr. and Joe DiMaggio. Holy
unbelievable.
Shit.
What year was DiMaggio born in?
1914. He's the oldest. He's old, like I did, I laid it out. JFK was born the same year as his younger brother Dom was born. And then RFK was born, you know, is the youngest. Joe DiMaggio is the oldest of the four.
Interesting.
Dom and JFK were born within like 2.5 months of each other.
I can't help but thinking of Field of Dreams in this regard. In that story, which is about baseball, they in the novel that it's based upon, they
J.D.
They
go Salinger, and they, the character,
yeah, they go and seek out J.D. Salinger. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the guy, really?
The character yeah, played by James Earl Jones.
Yeah, James Earl Jones. Was, yeah.
Okay, so Mark, I'm glad you mentioned Field of Dreams, because that was something when Andras was talking about this stuff, that's what I kept thinking about too, because he's doing this thing with the Tree of Life over the baseball field and things like that, and I'm thinking like Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come, and just like blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. But if you guys just said that the character in that is off J.D. Salinger, do you realize this was something, you know, Jay Widener has this idea that Eyes Wide Shut is released July 16th, which is the anniversary of the Apollo 11 launch, and we know Stanley's already referenced Apollo 11 in Shining and maybe 2001 and blah, blah, blah. But what I like to point out is that July 16th is also the day that Catcher in the Rye was first published. So Eyes Wide Shut, so not only does Apollo 11 and Catcher in the Rye and the Trinity Explosion and JFK Jr., and Eyes Wide Shut all happen on July 16th. So you have this Catcher in the Rye connection as well, and I see Eyes Wide Shut being, on another level, a reference to Catcher in the Rye. Here's this guy walking around, you know, walking around New York, and everything he finds is, it's not real. They're essentially all phonies, right? The guy he thinks is the doctor, oh, there's that, he's finding out that they're not what they seem. And it's the idea of trying to find himself and all this sort of stuff and being frustrated and almost fucking women, but then not really being interested and all this sort of stuff. It's almost like Holden Caulfield grows up.
Yeah, and, I love it.
And you even have where Holden, right, he travels to this school, but then he essentially gets kicked out of the school, or he travels back to New York from the school. Well, here you have Dr. Bill travels to the big mansion outside of New York, and then he comes back to New York. And it's this feeling of being rejected by the you know, whether that's in Connecticut or wherever it is, this I honestly don't know the geography of it, but that he goes to this sort of fancy place outside of New York and then comes back and keeps kicking around the sidewalk feeling dejected. It's the same idea.
Yeah.
Oh, no! I was thinking about... Well, no, that's funny because in my opinion... Eyes Wide Shut is a post 9/11 movie, basically. I believe that it's set on in the Christmas holidays that follow 9/11, making it a sort of prophetic film, basically. And I feel like Kubrick knew that this event in 2001 was going to happen, basically. And he was making a movie, and it's a very different film if you watch it from the perspective of everything it happens in the film happens shortly after the events of 9/11 in New York City, but. I wanted to just tie into the whole idea of Field of Dreams here too, and the candle in the wind thing. Well, if it's from Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, right? Well, the lyric in Goodbye Yellow Brick Road is, "You can't put me in your penthouse. I'm going back to my plow," basically.
Yes.
Right. And so, to me, this ties in to the concept of Stanley Kubrick as a Luddite, basically, and this has been written about at the Kubrick site. There's somebody who writes the whole article about was Stanley Kubrick against indoor plumbing, basically. And it's a very clever article that proposes that he was a kind of a technology Luddite, that Stanley Kubrick hated technology, essentially. And this idea of tying it into the entirety of a new order, and, you know, not to mention something, you know, that's a little bit corny, but the Georgia Guidestones, which are like monoliths sitting out there, that talk about culling the world's population, basically. And I believe, essentially, the idea is to return the world to a massive agricultural state as opposed to a technological state. So that's what we might be seeing the end of in terms of, you know, this idea of the Yellow Brick Road. Goodbye, Yellow Brick Road. I'm going back to my plow. So, and this ties in again to the return of Dorothy to a non-technological place, basically, right? She goes out of the world of color and back into the world of sepia, and she's back down on the farm